Ciao, sono Andrea Maderna, state ascoltando o guardando, se siete sul canale YouTube, un episodio un po' particolare di Outcast Weekly. Particolare perché? Perché c'è questa introduzione in italiano e poi vi lascio un'intervista in inglese, anche se vabbè, potete provare a utilizzare la funzione automatica di sottotitoli di YouTube in inglese o anche tradotto in italiano, non è perfetta, ma l'ho usata ogni tanto e mi sembra funzionare comunque ormai abbastanza bene nei limiti di una cosa automatica. Ad ogni modo, intervista in inglese, in video, seppur la faccio un po' tagliata perché vabbè, Skype ha registrato così, a Frank Sifaldi, una figura che abbiamo già trattato in realtà su Outcast.it con un mio vecchio articolo su un suo intervento alla GDC e con il reportage, il podcast sulla GDC dell'anno scorso in cui ho raccontato un suo altro intervento. Lui è una figura abbastanza importante nell'ambito della preservazione del videogioco, dello studio della storia del videogioco, anche del retro gaming. Comunque è molto vocale su cose che si fanno e non si fanno e ha collaborato con Digital Eclipse alla diverse ripubblicazioni e raccolte di classici del videogioco molto curate, ma soprattutto è il direttore della Video Game History Foundation, che è un'organizzazione no profit, vive di donazioni. Se volete andare a donare potete farlo, basta andare sul sito, e che si occupa di raccogliere, catalogare, archiviare materiale d'ogni tipo, non necessariamente le raccolte di videogiochi, ma codice sorgente, bozzetti, grafiche, motori, documentazioni, pubblicità, veramente la qualunque. Hanno una raccolta di praticamente qualsiasi rivista cartacea di videogiochi pubblicata in America, più anche pubblicazioni internazionali, veramente di tutto. E l'idea è di avere un grosso archivio consultabile, una biblioteca sostanzialmente, per chi magari vuole scrivere libri, articoli, comunque studia, lavora nel settore. Quindi veramente un progetto molto, molto interessante e molto importante, anche perché poi ci sono attività collaterali, appunto, come dicevo prima, di studio, di codici sorgenti, eccetera, da cui nasce quanto ha appena avviato, ovvero il Video Game Source Project, che è poi lo spunto da cui nasce l'intervista, e che è l'idea di proporre anche al pubblico i risultati dello studio di codici sorgenti. Hanno lavorato credo un paio di mesi su The Secret of Monkey Island, studiando il sorgente, scovando immagini, scene tagliate, grafica non utilizzata, e hanno organizzato questo streaming che si è svolto qualche giorno fa. C'erano i biglietti, era a pagamento, poi gli introiti vanno tutti comunque nel finanziare le attività, e per 2 ore lui si fa ha chiacchierato con Ron Gilbert, che è il creatore di Monkey Island, mostrando elementi del gioco, appunto cose nascoste, ma soprattutto anche mostrando il funzionamento dello SCAM, il motore usato per creare il gioco, e dei vari altri tool usati per creare le varie componenti, e parlandone appunto con il suo creatore. Quindi è anche una cosa interessante per mostrare un dietro le quinte che non sia solo le parti tagliate non utilizzate, che è comunque una cosa che si trova già su internet, ma far vedere il funzionamento, come sono stati sviluppati i giochi, che è una cosa che non si fa tanto spesso e che invece probabilmente bisognerebbe fare di più per aprire una finestra su come realmente funzionano le cose e capire meglio, almeno un pochino, come funziona questo mondo. Quindi interessante, sicuramente molto utile per chi è interessato alla storia del videogioco e anche non necessariamente alla storia, ma a un po' cosa succede dietro le quinte. È interessante come un po' tutta l'attività di Cifaldi. Sto parlando veramente troppo qua, il cuore all'intervista, voglio lasciarvi all'intervista. Abbiamo parlato di tutte queste cose che ho menzionato e anche di altro, di retro gaming, veramente tante cose. Quindi, se volete ascoltarvela o guardarvela in inglese, potete farlo con questo podcast. Se preferite avere una traduzione in italiano, l'avrete il prima possibile. È un'intervista piuttosto lunga, siamo andati ben oltre la mezz'ora prevista, quindi farò una trascrizione e traduzione in italiano, ci vorrà un pochino di tempo, ma arriverà su outcast.it. Nel frattempo potete ascoltarvi l'intervista di seguito. È tutto, ciao!
Well, first of all, could you like introduce yourself quickly, what you do, your whole different projects, like Video Game History Foundation, what, as you said, what you do with Digital Eclipse, the Source Project, all this stuff.
Oh, sure. My name is Frank Sifaldi. I'm the founder and the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation. We are a nonprofit in the United States dedicated to preserving video game history so that its stories can be told by really anyone, but, you know, historians, YouTubers, people who are writing history books, people who are making documentaries. We feel that there's not a lot of resources for this right now, that there's not really good archives to access to tell video game stories. So that is our main purpose. And then I also do a little bit, not nearly as much as I used to, of game development on the side with a studio called Digital Eclipse.
So your main activity is the Video Game History Foundation now?
Yes, my main job for the last 4 years has been the Video Game History Foundation. And while I occasionally will work on a Digital Eclipse project, currently I'm more of a consultant that works, you know, maybe 1 or 2 days a month right now. So it's not something I that's really a main part of my job anymore.
Okay, sure.
And that's on purpose. Yeah, you know, we're still friends.
Sure. I found out about you because I saw one of your talks at GDC. I saw it on the GDC channel. And then I think last year I saw you in person at GDC. So I've been stalking you because I'm really into game preservation. And
did you go to the talk last year too?
Yeah. I went to the talk last year. And I was fascinated by this wasn't in the talk last year. It was in the other talk, the whole comparison you made between movies and video games and the fact that you can rent, Uncle Buck, I think, was the example you made. Yeah, you can find Uncle Buck, but you cannot find necessarily the equivalent game from, I don't know, from the 80s. Do you see this getting better in any way with years going by or...
No, I mean, well, I mean, are you asking, is it better now, or are you asking if I project that it will get better?
Well, is it better from, I think it was from 4 or 5 years ago, that talk. Is it better now? Is it getting better?
Yeah. No, I don't think the state of things is any better now. And in fact, I would guess that the elimination of Nintendo's Virtual Console service alone is probably... made the percentage of older console games go down since that talk, would be my guess. I haven't looked into it, honestly. That said, I think that I think all the same trends have continued. I think, you know, you see things like Hamster's Arcade Archives. You still see the occasional M2 project. You still see Digital Eclipse projects. There's been, I think, maybe two more since that talk. So I think if you're asking, has the overall availability gotten better? No, because no one's stepped forward and provided a service, an easy to access service with a lot of older games. But that said, we are seeing older games sold more often, just in maybe disparate places, right? So yeah, the Uncle Buck analogy is really good because you can play, I mean, any movie, right? I mean, you understood the talk. It's just any movie from that era, basically, you can get. It's still true that you can get any movie on any device, pretty much. When you can get an old game, which is fairly rare, it's usually on one kind of device, maybe two, right? So while we're seeing a few more older games available, there's things like, oh, I forget what it's called. I think it's called the Evercade, that portable system. Yeah. So there's things like the Evercade.
That streaming service, Antstream?
Yeah, Antstream. I was about to look up. Did Antstream ever launch? I don't even know.
Yeah. I think it. I don't know if it's still in beta, but it's public anyway.
Yeah, there it is. Okay, it doesn't say beta. So yeah, that's going on too. So there's, I mean, it's, I think the overall number has gone up, probably. I think I'm taking back what I said earlier. I think the overall number of games has probably gone up a little bit, but it's still not easy to access, and things tend to get stuck on very proprietary networks and things. So, like, for example, I can't see something like Antstream being available on a video game console. You know, it's probably stuck forever on PCs, right? The Evercade.
I think in the Kickstarter campaign, they said that they wanted to go on PlayStation, but I'm not sure.
Of course they want to. Yeah.
Even if they do, they're gonna even if they do on PlayStation, they're maybe gonna have all those Spectrum and C64 games, but probably not Sony games, which would be bizarre.
I mean, they do have some partnerships, right? I think Taito and SNK are probably on Evercade, but it is. To your point, it is the lineup on a service right now, the lineup on a service like that right now. Is probably, you know, there's probably a lot of titles that wouldn't really inspire people much, mm-hmm. but that first of all doesn't surprise me, and second, I think it's true of any network when it launches, right? Like, if you go all the way back to when Netflix launched, it was a lot of content, but it was just a lot of, you know, it was a lot of old movies and TV shows that weren't really exciting, but I think that's necessary to launch a product and then you grow from there. So I can see AntStream becoming something substantial, but it's not, I don't think it's really exciting a lot of people yet. But it's, you know, but it's still pretty early in its life cycle, and it could be the one. I still think there's going to be a service that comes along that establishes the playbook for everyone else in the way that Netflix did, right? Like there's, you know, Netflix came along and really solved a lot of those issues and innovated that content on demand service. And I think that someone eventually will do that with games if they haven't already, if that's not Game Pass, you know, like Game Pass is still, it's newer games, but you know, that might be the one that takes off.
Yeah, in a way, I mean, streaming could make a lot of barriers disappear because there's not the hardware issue anymore. You theoretically can play, I don't know, a Mega Drive game or a NES game on whatever platform with streaming. Plus, maybe the fact that Xbox is pushing so much on retrocompatibility and PlayStation 5, you will be able to play PlayStation 4 game. So at least those sound like steps in the right direction.
Yeah, I can see it. And I don't know that I'm really the best one to ask any more about, you know, because about where that stuff's going, because it just hasn't been my job in like 4 years. You know what I mean? Sure. So like, I'm still watching it from a distance, but I'm not as kept up as I would have been when I gave that original talk on what's going on. So, you know, there could be things I'm not even aware of, honestly.
Sure.
They're happening.
I guess I'm asking you. Your point of view as a fan like me.
Yeah. I just keep in mind.
Pretty knowledgeable fan anyway.
It's not really my business anymore. So I'm not an expert like I was, you know.
Okay, then let's go on what is your business right now. We were supposed to do the interview last week. We didn't, so I had the chance to see the streaming, which
it probably answered a lot of questions.
Absolutely. And it was really cool, so I hope you do many more. But
I hope I don't. It killed me.
But I'm curious how I mean, I'm guessing you didn't just contact Ron Gilbert. You have been making calls to different sources. And I'm just curious if you have how the answers have been. Have you seen enthusiasm from the community of developers and publisher, or is there any kind of interest?
Well, I mean, it's, you know, no one's seen it yet, but the people who bought tickets. So everyone who's seen it was, of course, enthusiastic about it. We got a lot of positive reception for sure. We've got a lot of requests for doing more. Typically with other LucasArts or Lucasfilm Games employees, because that's probably mostly who we attracted with the Monkey Island stream. The reception's been great. I was really happy with how excited people were to see Scum and to see how Scum works, because that's really speaking to our mission with what we're calling the Video Game Source Project, right? We want people to understand how these games were made. Mm-hmm. And that, and I feel like people were more excited by seeing Scum in action than they were about the cut content, which is, it makes me feel really good that we're on the right track with what we're doing. I mean, the cut content is also from the source, but I want people to be more curious about how games were made. You know, I want them to dig a little deeper. I want people to talk about video game history in more interesting ways than we do right now. And so for people to really grasp onto how exciting it was to see the scripting language in action and like be inspired and want to learn more about how Scum works, that made me really happy that's what people were most excited about with the stream. But to go back to your question earlier, I mean, you were asking how it came about. I did ask Ron directly, but that I already had an established relationship with Ron. I've known him for years now, you know, just from being in the industry for so long. So yes, I just asked him directly if he would be interested in helping us out for the 30th anniversary with a charity stream. And he really, you saw in the stream, Ron's a big supporter of what we're doing. The Source Code Project specifically, sorry, the Video Game Source Project specifically, Source Code Project was the old name. I have to retrain myself. he supports it and he thinks it's a really good idea and that it's important. So he, you know, volunteered his time to do the stream with us, which was very cool of him. And then the source repository itself is something that was sent to our archives a long time ago. It might have even been last year or something. No, it was earlier this year. And it's something that, you know, we've spent many months going through and learning and figuring out how all the systems work. It's not simple. So when you saw, for example, the animations of the costume files, that's because we reverse engineered that format and wrote a tool to extract the costume files into animated GIFs.
Did you cooperate with Ron Gilbert in any way, or did you just present your findings?
I just presented. I mean, you know, Ron's busy making a game. He doesn't really have time to relive Scum from 30 years ago, you know, and again, this is 30 years ago. He hasn't seen this stuff in 30 years, if he ever even saw it at all. Like, a lot of this content might have just been artists making art that Ron never even saw. So, you know, we walked him through everything that we dug up and wanted to talk about and just kind of talked with him, like, do you remember this? What was this about? Or, like, you know, why might someone have done this? So we got some insight from him in that sense, but we didn't want to bother Ron with helping us debug Scum or anything like that. So instead we bothered Eric Wilmunder, who was co-author of Scum in the early days, because he's semi-retired, so he's got a lot more free time, and also he lives near us, so you know, he came over to our office to kind of bring what he had to see if, you know, any of his old artifacts were useful to us. But mostly he helped me debug some Scum issues that we were having, which, you know, we didn't end up resolving, actually, because it's impossible. But if you want to go deep into it, it's that the EGA version of Monkey Island, the dock scene where the Scum bar is, that room, you know, the outside room, in the EGA version, when you start the game, you see the sun setting back there. And as the game progresses, the sun sets, it goes away. Mm-hmm. And that's because it's using the same piece of art, but in code, they're changing the color palette so that it appears that the sun is gone now because it's replaced by blue. In the VGA version, you know, the 256 color version of the game, not the 16 color version, that feature doesn't exist anymore. And that's actually because the VGA version of Scum at least for in this era, maybe they changed it later, doesn't allow you to define color values in code. So that we couldn't make the sunset work. And I was trying to with Eric to do that. I'm going off on a tangent.
It's interesting. This is the interesting stuff. I mean, to the point you were making, of course, people would like to see the cutscene, the thing that wasn't in the game. And of course, if you're a game developer, to you, it could be interesting to see how Scum works. But it's nice that fans are interested into how Scum works, because that's not something usually fans are aware of and talk about.
Yeah, and I think we're fortunate that Scum is something that already had something of a legendary status. You know, like people had heard of Scum before. They named the bar in the game after Scum, right? And there's a lot of old interviews, even from the time that the games were new, talking about Scum. Like, it's something they marketed as technology that was exclusive to them. And fans had heard of the other tools too. They'd heard of phlegm and bile and spit and mucus, right? That's something that had been exposed in interviews before, so people knew about the tools. So I think that made it a lot more exciting to see him for the first time. I mean, I know it did for me, right? Mm-hmm. Like seeing in the repository, you know, phlegm.exe. I'm like, there it is. Let's what's it? How's it work? What's it do? Like, that was. You know, that was exciting for me, having spent so much time thinking about these games. But yes, like it's really nice to see people interested in how the games were made. It's something that I wanted to accomplish with this stream is hopefully this word makes sense to you. Demystify. Mm-hmm. I wanted to demystify the game development process a little bit so that you understood it better, because I think a lot of fans who haven't made games before don't entirely understand how it works and can't always conceive of the reality, which is like it's a group of people, you know, like duct taping things together and hoping it works, right? And then getting it out as bug free as they can. Like it's and I think in particular, video game history fans, because we've never had access to behind the scenes materials, we tend to obsess over the things that were cut from the game. So we tend to obsess over screenshots in magazines might have something slightly different, right? Or we, you know, the Cutting Room Floor Wiki, if you're familiar, does this amazing job of data mining the shipped games to find cut content. And I'm really interested in that stuff too. But because that's all we have, that tends to be what people really hyper focus on is the cut content. And in reality, you know, that stuff can be really interesting, but for the most part, it's cut on purpose. You know, like there are ideas that evolved and got thrown away because they weren't good anymore, you know, or the game's direction changed. And so to sort of, I wanted to change that conversation and talk more about the reality of like how this game was made, because that's more interesting to me. You know, it's more interesting to me to think about, and we brought this up in the stream, to think about how each room in the game was completely, you know, coded by one person, right? Mm-hmm. So all of the art, not the art, all the animation of the characters walking around, all the text, all of the way the puzzles are hooked up in one room is one person. And another room next to it might have been done by a different person, and they have different writing styles, but they all work together. And I think that tells us a lot more about what Monkey Island is than the art for the collapsing bridge or whatever, you know?
Sure, absolutely. Well, it's not necessarily related, but watching the stream was also watching the EGA version of the game, which for me as a kid basically didn't exist, because I played with the Amiga. So
I figured.
By the way, on the box, you only had screenshots from the 256 version and the 16 color version. There weren't any pictures from the Amiga version. So what? Yeah. And it's bizarre because I never played the EGA version. And recently I played the VGA version. Yeah. And I realized it's how in my memory the Amiga version was. And then I checked the Amiga version on YouTube. No, okay, it wasn't like that.
Yeah, the Amiga version took the art from the VGA version and compressed it down to 32 colors. So the VGA version would be like the master version of the Amiga version. Yeah.
Okay. But why do you think, I mean, why? It's probably not commercially viable, but I mean, you buy the special edition and you can play the classic version, but it's just one of the classic versions. And that's something also that's clearly missing. If you think of all the computer versions of arcade games, it would be nice to have access to the Spectrum 664, Amiga, whatever version of every game. I'm sure, of course, you have them on emulators, but I'm talking about...
Well, sure. I mean, I can't speak to the LucasArts projects, but yes, that's something that we try to do as much as we can with the Digital Eclipse projects.
Yeah.
So for example, SNK 40th Anniversary Collection, it was agreed early on, even though some people involved were like, why would we put the inferior versions? We wanted to include the NES games with their arcade counterparts. In that instance, it was really licensing that prevented any other versions, because all we were really focusing on were the games that SNK made. So for example, the Spectrum version of Athena, that's not something SNK made.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So like, that's why we didn't include that. With the Secret of Monkey Island Special Edition, which I think you were talking about, they decided not to include the EGA version, as you noted. My guess would be lack of awareness that there was anything special about it, right? As an historian and as a fan, I know that that was the original version. I know that that is the art that Ron and Tim and Dave were looking at when they created the game. I know that it's the first one that was released. I know that the VGA version, and we know this from the source code repository as well, we know that the VGA version just took the EGA art and painted over it, right? So, you know, as an historian, I understand the importance of the EGA version, but historian is not something that's typically assigned to a video game project, right? Like, you don't have an historian on staff unless you're Digital Eclipse. So it's something that's, those kinds of details are easily overlooked. So I think that's the reason why the EGA version is not there, maybe not available anywhere, is just maybe a lack of, and it might not be a total lack of understanding. We might have people internally who do understand that, but could have been, you know, overruled from up top from someone who didn't quite grasp it or said, no, we want to do the prettier version, right? Like, there's all kinds of reasons for not including that. I think it was a bad call. I think it was a bad decision. I don't like that you can't buy the original version of Secret Monkey. I don't like that the original version of Secret of Monkey Island has been out of print for 30 years. I think that's criminal. I think that's awful. But then again, it's the heart of Lucasfilm, right? to not have the original version available.
I mean, if you want to watch Star Wars as it was, right. It's kind of
company tradition to not sell you the original version, so it makes sense.
You don't think about that, but yeah, it makes sense. I became aware of this, Monkey Island specifically, but this source code project, because of a press release, and the press release, it says that you also already have other projects. There's a JRPG hardware stuff, arcade machine.
Yeah.
Which sounds really hard. I mean, you're differentiating quite a lot with other continents, completely different mentalities. that must makes it quite hard to do, I'm guessing.
Not really. I mean,
okay.
These days, I mean, any old game is a computer game to me because they're all emulated, you know.
Yes.
So it's not very different for me to handle this arcade game we alluded to because it's from the 90s and we got it emulated, you know, or the RPG I alluded to is something that runs in an emulator. So it's, well, okay.
Are there copyright issues in doing this?
Well, there would be copyright issues if we distributed the content,
sure.
Which we haven't. You know, the Monkey Island source code that we have, you know, we can't just put it on the internet. That's Disney property. So, but, you know, in terms of editorial content, no, I think that falls, at least in the United States, under fair use, is what we call it. But that said, you know, we try not to. We did talk to Lucasfilm, for example, before the Monkey Island stream because we wanted them to know what we were doing. We didn't want to surprise them, and we just wanted to make sure that we weren't doing anything that was upsetting them. And you know, we got it cleared. So that was fine. And then with the other stuff, we're in contact with some of the people who worked on it. We're unable for any of the projects we're working on to obtain the copyrights to the games. That's outside of our scope. And it's something that would probably require an amount of money that we don't even have. You know, we are for the most part, at least working with, actually, in every instance of the content that we teased, we are at least working with someone who worked on the project back in its time. So it's not the same as getting copyright permission, but sure. We are at least working with people who worked on the project to make sure that we're telling the story correctly.
And with stuff this old, do you think there could be issues like, I don't know, a publisher who doesn't want you to reveal stuff that is in the source code?
I've never had that issue with any publisher.
Okay.
But I think there's a common sense line. I think that if you're going to publish something that could embarrass someone, for example, I think that you need to avoid that. And we saw some of that with the Nintendo leaks, which really disappointed me, that people were digging up personal correspondence that was still on the person's hard drive that got leaked and, you know, tweeting it at them. People were finding curse words in video game source code, which, oh my gosh, never happens. Of course it does. Because no one's supposed to look at it. And, you know, like tweeting that publicly and tagging the author and things like that. And that's it revealed an immaturity, I think, in how people understand this content. And they don't, I don't think people are able to generally look at this content and understand, like, this was a person's computer, you know, like there's stuff on your computer too that you don't, that you'd be embarrassed if people tweeted. And so, I mean, that's a long way of just explaining that the sort of cut content and unreleased games and stuff like that, we've never gotten pushback from publishers. We've only gotten, you know, positive feedback. When we talked about the unreleased version of SimCity for the NES, for example, we had no contact with Nintendo on that, but we had a really positive conversation with EA. You know, they were excited that there was a part of their history that they'd never seen, you know, that they could now. And we had a really nice meeting about how they should be promoting SimCity's history, for example. So, you know, I mean, people in the industry tend to be fans too. You know, that's not a big secret. So a lot of this old content, especially if it's old enough that it's not threatening anyone commercially, like the reaction is only positive. You know, there's no one that's upset that we showed cut art from Monkey Island. We didn't show anything, you know, embarrassing or vulgar or, you know,
There's not a hot coffee in Monkey Island.
Yeah, there's nothing like that in the source, thankfully. But yeah, so no, it's not been an issue. Copyright, of course, is something that is a nice to have, but it's just unrealistic for a lot of the work that we're doing. That's why we tend to publish content around it, not the actual files themselves. Sometimes we publish the files, not every time. It's just a matter of, again, of common sense. Like, are we going to make anyone mad if we put this out? So we do have to walk this tightrope because we have this content in our collection that theoretically a researcher could come study. We can't let them take it home or anything like that.
Sure. And in terms of the work you do with the Video Game History Foundation, I mean, when at least from my experience in Italy, when you think mm-hmm. about preservation and museums, the common idea is, you know, this place where you go to and there's, I don't know, the box behind the glass.
Sure.
Maybe you can play a level. But it seems like a very basic way of showing the past of video games. Do you have any ideas of how... Well, I mean, the collection you made with Digital Eclipse, maybe those are the real museums because you can actually go into the games, play them in different versions and documentation and stuff.
Yeah.
It's not just you, but it's certainly better than seeing a box.
I agree. And also, we tend to have the boxes in there, too. The idea of putting a video game in a museum is still very new. I don't know what analogy to compare it to. I don't know. You know, does film have the same struggle? I don't know, but they tend to show props and things like that, I guess, when there's displays of film history. If you're asking me straight up, I'm also bored with museum displays that are just physical retail games and, you know, the controller to play with. I don't think it's anyone's fault. I think we're all collectively still figuring out what's a video game museum. I find the concept interesting from a distance philosophically, but I am not interested in public display as a form of teaching video game history. That's not my passion personally. My passion, well, like you said, the Digital Eclipse projects are at least partially my statement on what a digital video game museum is. But more than that, the Video Game History Foundation, our focus is not, you know, we're not a museum. We're not a public, you know, we don't have office hours. You could just walk in when you feel like it kind of thing. Like, we are an archive that exists so that people can access material that would help them write a book, film a documentary, like help them understand history better. It's a place of study. It's a library. That's our approach to preserving history, right? The museum approach is certainly another one. And it's surely an effective one. I've gone to most video game museums, you know, like I enjoy them. I've gone to exhibits. I was on the advisory board for the Smithsonian's exhibit, for example. But it's just one way of preserving history is letting people look at the physical artifacts. And it's not one that I'm personally that interested in. We do a little bit of it, though.
But you are. Come on, you wouldn't do the collection. You wouldn't do the stream if you weren't interested in showing these things to the.
I mean the retail games and like giving you like I don't personally think it's that important that like someone sits down with the original video game controller for the Mega Drive.
Sure.
You know, like I don't care. Like that.
That's
to me
a controversial thing to say. You know that
I don't care. Like, it's my personal opinion. I don't run a museum. So, like, I don't think it's that important that people can access real... Like, that people can walk into a museum and play on real hardware for most things. I will actually think... I do think it's important for a lot of arcade games, for example, to understand the form of the cabinet and how the joystick felt and things like that. But my passion is not giving people access to original games and original hardware. That there's other ways of doing that, and like, you know, there's museums that do that already. There's eBay if you really, really want to. You know, there's a lot of ways to do that, and it's the same reason we don't collect retail video games at the Video Game History Foundation. In my mind, that's a solved problem. There are collectors. Video games is a hot collectible item. There are collectors who are always going to do a better job than a museum of collecting retail video games. And those collectors, many of them eventually are going to be donors. So I'm not worried about collecting retail video games. So that's why we focus on the things that collectors either aren't focused on or just kind of can't access, right? So the source code for The Secret of Monkey Island, you know, that's not something that, it's not a physical object that goes on mm-hmm. a shelf. It's a digital collection that was donated. Or, you know, we have physical artifacts from game developers as well. Like we've got a really substantial collection of paper artwork that was used for Disney's Aladdin on the Sega Genesis. So the original animation frames before they got scanned in, things like that. And that's the kind of stuff that, you know, a collector wouldn't have access to. That's the kind of thing that in this case, Mike Dietz, who did the art, donated to us so that people could learn from it. So that's why we're more focused on that stuff than, you know, when people want to donate stuff to us, we tend to say, like, if it's on eBay right now, we're not interested. You know, it's kind of our line. Like, if you can buy it, then like we don't mind, we don't care. And that tends to be our line. I mean, there's some exceptions because we are trying to collect every magazine, for example. Yeah.
Okay. And in terms of you were talking about you're not interested in using the real hardware from back in the day, but you did work on emulation. And
yeah. Just I'm not saying that like. Well, I'm saying I'm not interested in teaching history through making.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
That's all absolutely. I mean. I still play on original hardware at home. Like I have a CRT and play on original hardware. That's what I do.
I was sure about that.
Yeah,
and it's just that you made me think how much of a struggle, because you think with today hardware the person who's not really tech savvy would think how hard can it be to emulate perfectly a game from the 80s, but from what I hear, I'm not an expert, it's actually sometimes really hard because chips, I don't know, maybe the sound of the Commodore 64.
Oh, there's a lot of there's a lot of complications with emulation for sure. Yeah, I mean, the biggest ones for me, I mean, you saw my second GDC talk. The biggest ones for me are translating a control scheme to a controller that is nothing like that control scheme, right? So you might remember how we struggled with Akari 3, for example, like how hard that was to make it play correctly on an Xbox controller or Switch or whatever. So there's a lot of complications with that. I mean, when you're talking about sound chips, things like that, yeah, that stuff can get really complicated too. And a lot of it is just because there's, especially in the world of arcade games, there's just so many of them that it's just a matter of, you know, how mature is the reverse emulation of that component? And in a lot of cases, very mature. Like if you look at the MAME source code, a lot of chips are very, very well documented and understood. Others, not so much. And it's because that's a big community project, right? Like it's not something that's like funded or so it's like it depends not only on people volunteering time, but like those people being interested enough to go after that thing, right? I mean, you know, like in working on SNK 40th, we found a lot of things that MAME got wrong, and it's not like their fault. It's just that, you know, I was paid to figure this out. They weren't, you know, so I probably researched harder or in some cases it's like, it might be a game that was emulated in MAME in like the 90s and never looked at again, you know, and now that, time has evolved and we have things like YouTube, we can access video of people playing on the real cabinet and go, oh, wait, the colors were wrong in MAME. We should fix that. You know, like that's something that it's such a huge project. Am I answering your question? Is that what you were going to ask?
Yeah. It was a very general question. So okay. I think we're running out of time. I just have a couple of more out there questions to finish. One is, a single game that will probably never be published again because of copyright issues or it's not interesting enough from the public, but that you would really, really, really like to see out again to preserve forever, maybe to work on it. I don't know.
I mean, my dream projects at Digital Eclipse were always Monkey Island and Mother 3. So those are good answers. I think both are games that haven't been treated particularly well in terms of access to them. You can get Secret of Monkey Island Special Edition. You can play the main game for sure, but I don't feel that there's been a release of Monkey Island that the first one anyway that speaks to me as the fan, as someone who wants to celebrate its history. I think that Special Edition did a good job of creating a product that would put the game in front of new people by having HD graphics. But I think that game is worthy of something a lot bigger than that. I think it's worthy of something that's a little more quiet and reflective and is celebratory of its history as opposed to a visual facelift. So that's a big one. Mother 3, of course, was never officially released outside of Japan. The audio in the Game Boy Advance game can be improved dramatically because it actually gets compressed by the hardware. So the raw audio for Mother 3 sounds a lot better than anything you can actually play. So restoring that would be great. Increasing the screen draw size so that it's 16:9 now would be great. But also for Mother 3, that game started life as a Nintendo 64 game, got really far along, and we know that there are playable demos of that canceled version of the game that I would love to present as like a look behind the curtains of how this game was made to show you, you know, that original version and how that played, and so that you understand some of the decisions that were made in the Game Boy Advance version. So yeah, those would be my two.
Sure.
That I would personally like to work on, because I think I could do them some justice, I guess.
Do you think retro gaming and in general games from the past are, I don't know, breaking through with younger people? Because of course I'm gonna be interested. I've been playing since the Atari VCS. I like the history of games, but do you think, I don't know, a kid right now likes Super Mario Bros. For NES?
But it's because content creators are making content with them. So I think I go to not this year because of the pandemic, but I go to Portland Retro Gaming Expo every year, which is the largest one of those in the US. And I see tons of small children who are very excited by what's around them, who are like explaining older games to their parents who are around at the time but didn't know about them. So there is an interest, but I don't think that it's ever going to be like a giant market for kids to sell old stuff. And I don't think it should be. I think that kids should be inspired by new things, you know, sure. Like what they should. But that said, a big part of my passion for wanting older games to be available to people is that I still think I don't necessarily believe that like we should sit young kids down with old games and make them play it or anything like that. I don't think they need to, but I think there's so many ideas from the old days that haven't been fully explored and fleshed out that I want people to be able to find them if they're interested, so that they can be inspired to create weird new art that excites me, right? Like, I mean, Undertale is such a classic example. Undertale doesn't happen if Toby Fox doesn't have access to the Earthbound ROM and emulator and hacking tools, right? That's where Toby Fox got his start. And that's what became Undertale, which is now its own thing, right? And if we don't have access to this older stuff, we're going to lose out on like the Undertales of tomorrow. And I think that's really upsetting.
Yeah. I played with my daughter all the Pat games from Ron Gilbert. Yeah. She loved them. But after playing all of them, she went back to the first one and she was already complaining because the graphics were low res. And she was 4 years old. So, okay. But yeah.
Yeah, she's used to Putt-Putt in Space or whatever. Can't go back to the parade.
Well, anyway, just one last question that I give to everyone. What is the last great game you played and why do you think is great? It can be a new game, an old game, doesn't matter.
I'm currently playing Dragon Quest XI. And it is so comforting. Because it's just a JRPG. That's all it is. It's not trying to be anything else. And it's not ashamed of it. So it is just the most classic traditional JRPG possible, but it's beautiful as an Unreal Engine. I'm able to run it on my computer at 4K 60 FPS and it looks amazing. So I'm having a really good time with that right now. I don't know if I'd say that it's not a groundbreaking game, but I've been playing for dozens of hours, maybe a half hour at a time, just like come in, chip at it, go walk away from it again. And I'm really enjoying playing it that way as opposed to marathoning it, and Dragon Quest games in particular are really good at that. They're really good at giving you something to do that takes maybe a half hour and then you save your game and then you go on with your life. And so I'm really enjoying it for that reason. And then before that, the last game that I played that I was really into was Control. I really like Control. I thought that I had really good combat mechanics. I thought the way that the world was connected really seamlessly was cool. I thought the art direction was amazing in that one. So I really recommend Control as well.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. All right.